Some say the big problem is not fossil fuels, it's the food we eat. If what they say is true, we simply must ask, are we eating up the earth?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1397th edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we have, as a body politic, changed direction by voting out one president and voting in another. The president we voted out was said to be very supportive of the green energy initiatives that fight global warming by reducing carbon emissions. The president we voted in is supporting green economy instead of green energy, and is campaigning with the battle cry, drill, baby, drill. Our collective about face has left many confused as to what we should now be most concerned with. Here's something. Though at least 95% of climate coverage and 97% of climate finance is focused on energy and fossil fuels, one-third of all global carbon emissions are generated by our food systems. And while the energy problem is getting better, the food problem is getting worse. If such is indeed the case, we ask, are we indeed eating up the earth? Who better to ask than Michael Grunwald, who is the author of We Are Eating the Earth. Welcome to the Food Chain, Michael.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Yes, well, tell us, when did the apple fall on your head that made you realize that we are, in fact, eating the earth?
You know, that's a great question. I'll tell a little story. Because I was a climate reporter. Not full-time, but I wrote a lot about the climate, environment. I had written a book about the Everglades and another book that had a lot about clean energy initiatives under Obama. And I had written a magazine story about my own life in the green energy economy. I had gotten an electric car and I had solar panels on my roof. And I had a line in my story about that I wanted to show that I wasn't some kind of eco-saint, that I was really kind of an eco-mercenary. And I knew enough about the new green economy that I knew that doing this was going to save me money. So I had a line saying that, I didn't unplug my computer at night and I didn't line dry my laundry and I still ate meat. And when I was going and doing the fact check, I realized, is eating meat even bad for the climate? Like, I didn't know. And I was a climate reporter. And so I called this guy who I knew was interested in agriculture and climate, this guy, Tim Searchinger, who I had worked with on stories in the past. And I said, hey, Tim, is meat really that bad for the climate? And he said, yes. And then he said, duh. Tim's a kind of a brusque personality sometimes. But honestly, that was the beginning of my six-year journey because I did really realize that if somebody who thought about the climate, quite often didn't know that meat was a big part of the problem and that beef in particular was an even bigger part of the problem, then probably most people didn't know that. And, there were a million climate books about energy and fossil fuels. So I thought it was time to write about, the other one-third of the problem.
Well, Tim Searchinger seems to be a big part of your presentation. So tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Tim's a guy who I first knew when he was just a wetlands lawyer. He was interested. We did a lot of work together when I was writing all these stories about the Army Corps of Engineers. He actually gave me the first tip about the kind of messed up Everglades restoration project that led me to check out this project, write a series about it for the Washington Post, and then move to Florida and write a book about it. and meet my wife and have kids. So he's been an important part of my life. I really didn't realize that he had become this agriculture and climate guy. And it turns out that while he was, you know, focusing on just sort of trying to save Midwestern wetlands, he got interested in corn ethanol. And he essentially realized that corn ethanol was a huge environmental problem, even though it was being touted as this great environmental solution. And the reason, to vastly oversimplify, was that it was eating the earth. It was using all of this land. You had to take land to grow fuel. And if you were using corn to grow ethanol, that meant that somewhere else you had to use more land to grow corn for food. And that land wasn't going to be in a parking lot. It was going to come out of wetlands and forests that stored a lot of carbon and, you know, sheltered a lot of biodiversity, and it was going to create huge climate problems. And so he essentially realized that biofuels were this giant climate problem. He wrote the first article in Science, which usually just publishes scientists, but they published him because he showed it was a disaster. And what he ended up realizing is that while biofuels are a big problem and they're eating a part of the earth the size of Texas, livestock are eating 50 Texases, and agriculture in general is eating 150 Texases. So this is really a massive problem. We're now 2 of every 5 acres of land on our planet are going to grow our food. And you know, we can't really, you know, every time we have a larger agricultural footprint, we have a smaller natural footprint, and that can't continue.
The realization that things can get worse.
Yeah, exactly. Right? People always say, like, oh, you know, things couldn't possibly get worse. It's not true.
But they can. In how bad can they get?
Well, look, you know, to on our current trajectory, and this is even if we continue to increase our crop and livestock yields at the same rate they've increased since the start of the Green Revolution 60 years ago. And that's going to be really hard because now most farmers have fertilizer and they have large-scale irrigation. So, you know, we can't increase their yields by giving them that, you know, by giving them new technologies. It's going to be an incredible challenge. But even if we did all that, we're currently on a course to deforest another 2 Indias worth of land by 2050. And if that happens, then you can kind of say goodbye to the Amazon and, you know, the Congo rainforest. Now, if yields don't increase at all, then we'd deforest another 7 Indias. And at that point, you know, we'd have to find a planet B. So really things can get a lot worse.
Yes, having been in the Amazon and seeing the smokes rising as we flew into Pucallpa, you know, you could just see, look out, and you could just see smokes rising, and you know what they're doing. They're just chopping down the Amazon.
That's right.
To make croplands, grow crops, and feed the world, I guess.
And to run cattle, particularly.
Right?
I always say that when you, you know, that when you eat a burger, you know, you're not just eating a cow, you're eating the jaguars and the macaws and the rest of the cast of Rio, yeah. Right? Because you're eating the Amazon.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Michael Olson's first law of the food chain: agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. If agriculture fails, we're all hunters and gatherers, rolling over logs to see if there's anything to eat underneath. So, and you know, it's pretty easy for us city people to forget that very elemental fact because we're disassociated with agriculture to the greatest extent possible. Whereas most people in the world still live pretty close to their agriculture, we live 1,200 miles away from it, or something like that.
And the poorer the country, the closer they are to agriculture.
That's correct.
Right? You know, not having to farm is a luxury, right? Like that you get to podcast and I get to write. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners get to be, you know, bankers and doctors and
we're all doing
influencers.
Something else. Absolutely.
You know, and that is made possible by agriculture, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'm trying to point out that that agriculture is making a mess, but we got to eat. And so agriculture isn't optional.
Well, it isn't an optional for us, and especially living in a very complicated city-dominated world where our food comes wrapped in plastic and with promising notions prominently displayed on them. And yet it is what we have, and we're going to take a break here in a few minutes, but what I want to get into is where did we go wrong with agriculture? Or did we go wrong? Is it just, did we have no choice? Because I guess if you go way back in time 10,000 years ago and we started planting seeds in the ground instead of herding animals or whatnot, that's probably where we started going wrong when it gets right down to it.
Well, it's certainly when we started transforming our environment and, you know, making a mess. Agriculture has always made a mess. Oh. It's when we started transforming nature into farmland and pasture land. But it's also when we started to feed larger numbers of people, right?
There
so
it
is that going wrong? I mean, I think the people that were fed would say no. You know, what I'm... you know, what I'm certainly talking about in my book is obviously not, you know, getting rid of agriculture. It's how can we make agriculture not more sustainable, which isn't necessarily kind of kinder and gentler farming, that Michael Pollan loves and, you know, people talk about at the farmer's market. It's how can we make more food? How can we, without cutting down more forests? When I talk about how can we feed the world without frying the world, the fact is that we've gotten pretty good at feeding the world. And if we have to, we'll tear down more forests and make more food. The trick will be to do it without frying the world. And that's going to require a lot of pretty radical changes.
Okay. And so, agriculture you see really is the problem here. It's not even so much fossil fuels. It's agriculture.
Well, I wouldn't say, no, look, fossil fuels are still about 2/3 of the problem, right? And you know, it's a huge problem. and you know, the good news is that, first of all, you can imagine a future without fossil fuels, while you cannot imagine a future without agriculture because we got to eat. And look, we know what we need to do with fossil fuels. We need to basically electrify as much of the economy as we can and run it on clean electricity. And we're starting to do that, just not fast enough. And it really matters whether it takes 30 years or 20 years or 40 years. But we know how that story ends. The reason I wrote this book is that we don't know how the agriculture story ends. And honestly, we don't even know, you know, what that story is. We haven't even really started to grapple with it. And my book tries to grapple.
It's a lot of grappling to be done. When you take on agriculture, you're taking on a pretty big industry here in the United States, and there's a lot of vested interests in the way things are done. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Michael Grunwald, who's the author of the brand-new book, We Are Eating the Earth. And as I said, when we come back, we want to take on agriculture and see if we can come up with the solution to what the problem might be. So do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio program with Michael Olson and Michael Grunwald, the food people. That's what we talk about and we write about. So stay tuned. We will be right back.
to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
With Michael Grunwald, author of We Are Eating the Earth, just published, will be on the bookshelves within days, so watch out for it. Michael, we're talking about agriculture, and we're discussing the fact that, well, if we don't have a successful agriculture, we're going to be hunters and gatherers again. But what can we do?
Well, look, I think most farmers and ranchers, I think they consider themselves good stewards of the land. But I think if we're going to be honest about this, we have to say that collectively they're stewarding a mess. Agriculture is by far the leading driver of water shortages. It uses 70% of fresh water, water pollution. You look at the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, that comes from synthetic fertilizers, the algal blooms in the Great Lakes, the damage to my beloved Everglades coming from agriculture, and particularly biodiversity loss. Because look, we're, mostly because of agriculture, we're losing a soccer field worth of rainforest every 6 seconds. And that's because we have a giant appetite as a species, right? There are 8 billion of us, we're heading towards 10 billion by 2050, and we got to eat. So I think, when I talk about, a future where agriculture is more sustainable, that's not an argument for a certain type of agriculture. Okay. It's not, certainly I'm not the one saying factory farms or industrial farming is evil. And we can talk about that. But what I am saying is that we are going to need highly productive agriculture because we're going to need about 50% more calories by 2050. We're going to have to make more food over the next 25 years than we've made over the last 10,000. And we're going to have to do it with less mess. We're going to have to do it with less land in particular because, we can't keep using, we can't use more than 40% of the earth for agriculture. We all know it. When you take a cross-country flight and you look out the window at all those squares and circles, like our civilization is a primarily agricultural civilization. That's what we use our land for. And every time our agricultural footprint expands, our natural footprint shrinks, which is a problem for the bugs and bunnies. But since all that nature stores a lot of carbon that we need to keep down here and not in the sky, that's a problem for us too.
We were truly blessed with good land to work with too here in the United States. Not so much other places in the world. Yes, we have to figure out how to get more crops from less land, which is the basic theme of your story, correct?
That's right. And I think that's we need to have less land intensive diets, which essentially means that in the rich world, we're going to have to eat less beef and lamb and other ruminant meat because they're by far the most land intensive form of food. They can use like 100 times as much land per calorie as beans and 10 times as much as chicken and pork. Yeah. And yes, we're going to need on the supply side, we're going to need to make more food and more meat with less land.
Let me back up a little bit. In 1900, F.H. King, who was the Secretary of Agriculture in the United States, came out with a book titled Farmers of 40 Centuries. And he traveled to Asia and was curious as to how people grew their food there. Because we here in the United States had all of this modern equipment and tractors and all these chemicals, and we were really rocking it out with respect to agriculture. So he went there and found people with nothing. And yet people with nothing on a half acre of land were supporting 20 people and selling crops for cash money on the side. So it was an incredibly intensive cultivation practices that allowed them to do that. And it was a cultivation practices that sustained the farmland for 4,000 years, 40 centuries. And so it seems like that is kind of one kind of agriculture that could answer what you're talking about with respect to agriculture, but that would mean putting people back on the land and taking them out of the city where they're hanging around on the street corners in hooded sweatshirts, you know.
Right. Well, yes, I was going to say that was a very labor-intensive form of farming.
It was, it was what agriculture had been forever. It was based on the time of a farmer being out in the field. And when we industrialized that agriculture, we changed the input from that of time in the field to money.
I think that's true. And look, you know, there's a question about how scalable that is. And there's also a question about where the actual environmental damage came from, right? You know, I talk a lot about Michael Pollan in my book, and he's, don't get me wrong, he's like a great writer. You know, I wish I could write like him, but he sort of romanticizes this kind of old style farming. These farms like, you know, like Aldo Leopold's farm in sure. Sand Country Almanac, right? Where, you know, where it's, you know, it's diverse crops. It's very close to the land. You know, it's not none of these toxic pesticides or, you know, these monoculture fields that are just, you know, corn or soy, not these factory farms where you're, you know, with, you know, these kind of chicken factories that kind of make a lot of us uncomfortable. And he really kind of talks about how beautiful that is and you know, and how sad it is that we've given that up for these, you know, kind of industrial systems where the animals have numbers instead of names and the soil isn't treated very nicely. But what's interesting, and don't get me wrong, there are some environmental costs to intensification of agriculture, and we can talk about that. But it's if you read Aldo Leopold, who is also a wonderful writer, he wasn't romanticizing his own farm. What he romanticized was the prairie that was displaced by his farm. The real environmental disaster of the Midwest was the transformation of this kind of natural Serengeti into these bucolic red barn farms that Michael Pollan loves, right? And that's really, you know, that was what got Aldo Leopold upset. And today, I still think that while it is true that there are things we can do on our farmland that is taking up 40% of the earth to try to make it, you know, less environmentally nasty, the real environmental challenge is to make sure it doesn't take up 50, 60% of the earth. Because where nature really thrives is where it's left alone, where it can remain a forest or a wetland. You know, when that forest gets cut down or that wetland gets drained so that we can have a larger agricultural footprint, that's the environmental disaster that I'm trying to, you know, that I'm trying to warn about.
Sure.
And the fact is that that environmental disaster is going to is more likely to happen when our farms have lower yields, when they make less food. Because if you can make less food per acre, you're going to need more acres to make food.
Cattle, sounds like, are the bad guys here. What makes the cow so bad for agriculture?
You know, they really are. You know, cattle are the baddies. They're cute. But, you know, the short answer is that they're just an extraordinarily inefficient way of turning, you know, what they eat into what we eat. And I know a lot of ranchers, they'll say like, you know, they take grass that we can't eat and turn it into beef that we can. And there's something to that. But the fact is it takes an extraordinarily a large amount of pasture to turn a cow into beef. And that pasture has an opportunity cost. I mean, you know, 40% of today's pasture land used to be forest. On earth. And so when you say it's like, oh, this is like kind of land that wasn't doing anything, it was storing a lot of carbon. And yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I stopped eating beef when I started working on this book, because basically, you know, if you're writing about food and climate, it's kind of hard to explain to people that you still eat beef. And I got to tell you, I love beef. I miss it. People said I would only miss it for like a month. I still miss it. I did some reporting in Brazil. I went to like a bunch of cattle ranches. I fell off the wagon and that stuff was exquisite. It's amazing. I totally understand it. But the fact is, you know, we Americans, we eat the equivalent of 3 burgers a week. And if we only ate 2 burgers a week, we would save the equivalent of a Massachusetts worth of farmland every year. So yeah, beef for, and that's not even talking about their, you know, about their burps and farts, which, right. Which are a real methane problem. You know, it's not as big a problem as the land problem. The real problem with cattle is that they're eating so much of the earth. But the farts, the burps, they don't help either. And the fact is the less efficient a system, the longer it takes those cattle to reach slaughter weight, the more they're burping and farting. And that's why when people say grass-fed beef is, we just need better beef. You know, grass-fed beef is even worse for the climate.
How is that? How is grass-fed? Because the animal lasts longer to grow up to weight.
They're a lot. Yeah, exactly. It's say what you will about these feedlots, but they and it's important for people to recognize that even feedlot finished beef spend most of, the cattle spend most of their lives on grass. It's just the last few months of their lives that they're fattened up in a feedlot, but that can be the difference between being alive, burping and farting for 2 years and four years. And that does make a big difference. And the fact is, growing the corn, does take some land, but not nearly as much land as you need for grass. And again, I think, we get upset about Brazil and we should, it's terrible what's happening in Brazil, all the deforestation, mostly for cattle, some for soy. And it really is it's a global disaster what's happening. But Indiana used to be 85% forest. So again, we can point our fingers and say, you are bad. You are deforesting. You are creating this environmental disaster. But that's only because we already deforested our Amazon. Right. So, our beef production, we don't cut down trees to do it because we already cut down our trees so long ago, or we already converted our natural grasslands into pastures. But the beef we eat is, has that same global impact as the beef they're eating in Brazil.
There's been a significant amount of effort being put into restoring the prairies. And a big part of that restoration is having ruminants to recycle the carbon, as it were. Now, do you see a possibility in that kind of agriculture of bringing back the prairies, of actually grass feeding the ruminants? Do you see that as a valid way of ameliorating the climate change that you're talking about?
I mean, I think if I'm going to be honest, I would say it's modest at best. Mm-hmm. Most of what I'm talking about is kind of a math problem. And I think it's great when you turn, cattle pasture or farms into prairie. That's awesome. But somewhere, the food does need to be replaced. And if there are, regenerative practices that can match the yields that the farms were producing in the past, I think that's fantastic. And when I did visit Brazil, some of those ranches that I visited were doing a lot of regenerative practices. They were, doing no-till. They were planting cover crops. They were letting the cattle, graze, integrating them with the crops, just like Michael Pollan wants them to. And they were getting incredible yields. Now granted, they also had feedlots and they were fertilizing their pastures and using chemicals that Michael Pollan wouldn't like at all. So I do think that there's a lot that, some of these food questions have become kind of culture war. They're ideological, they're almost religious. When to me, they're more kind of analytical and they're math. You know, it's like, you know, how much food can we make with how much land and how much mess? And okay. I'm for anything that makes more food with less mess and less land.
Okay. And of course, when it gets right down to it, feedlots are a big part of that because you get a lot of cattle in a very small space and fatten them up. Feedlots are a lot like cities when it gets right down to it.
Efficiency. Exactly, exactly, right? People talk about urban sprawl, right? It's like, oh, and it's destroying all, you know, it's destroying our nature. Well, you know, the world, about 1% of our, you know, habitable land right now is covered by cities and suburbs and highways and driveways and kind of our, you know, our kind of urban and exurban landscape. And that, you know, that's how far we've sprawled as a kind of urban civilization. Well, as I've said, agriculture is 40%. It's 40 times as much. So agricultural sprawl is a way bigger threat than urban sprawl. But as you said, it's very much a similar, it's the same kind of concept where if we can, you know, we can have more higher density production, just like higher density residential living, then we don't need, you know, to sprawl out as far. And actually you do see in China now, they're starting to have these pig skyscrapers, these 26-story skyscrapers where they're growing pigs. And again, you know, say what you want and, you know, may not be the most fun place for a pig to be. But
it seems to be working for the Chinese.
I think efficiency has become this kind of dirty word. And particularly in the environmental movement, right? It's like these rapacious conglomerates that are sort of squeezing dollars out of the dirt. But efficiency is really important because it's, you know, efficiency is what's, we're going to need it to save the Amazon. And when you talk about, you know, what's the problem with cattle or what's the problem with low yield organic farming that, you know, that sprawls across, you know, more acreage than industrial farming. It's essentially inefficient. It's like it's taking solar energy from the sky and converting it into calories for us in a less efficient way than, you know, than we know how.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about the looking for efficiencies in things such as vertical farming. So do stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Olson here with Michael Grunwald, author of We Are Eating the Earth. We're trying to figure out how we can eat the earth without eating the earth, I guess, when it gets right down to it. So do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the U.S. USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, and we are talking food, and of course, what's eating what? And curious, Michael Grunwald, author of We Are Eating the Earth, do you think there's any way that cows can make sense?
It's a great question. I mean, look, I think, there are a lot of regenerative ranchers likes to say that it's not the cow, it's the how. And I think part of what I'm saying is that to some extent it's the cow, that ruminants really are inherently less efficient. But also I think a lot about what Willie Sutton said when they asked him why he robbed banks, and he said, that's where the money is. If you're interested in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you've got to look at cows because that's where the emissions are. And so that means that more productive ranching better grazing systems that can support more cows per acre can make a dramatic difference. And the fact is, there are like vegan activists who, they're just like, meat is murder. So they don't even want to think about how can we make our ranching systems more efficient. And then you've got, a lot of the kind of meat lobby, which kind of likes things the way they are. So they don't really want to, think about this stuff either. But I think one of the most important ways that we can, protect the Amazon, protect the climate is by, helping ranchers to get more efficient and make more beef with less land and fewer emissions.
Well, they're certainly doing that with pigs in China, as you talked about. They're stacking them up 20 stories high and whatnot.
When I went to Brazil, I saw these ranches where they were, they would take degraded ranches. They would, they would make some improvements to, they would add some infrastructure. They would spend, maybe as much as $1,000 an acre. But they would increase their yields, their beef yields, 4 or 5 times. And that means they were using 1/4 or 1/5 as much of the Amazon. So I just think there are, real opportunities to make progress. And at the beginning, you talked about, we talked about a little bit of this idea of, can things get worse? And I do like to point out that, yes, things can get worse. You can't just throw up your hands and not do anything, but things can get better too. And, it sounds stupid, but better is better than worse. A lot of people will say like, that's not a real solution. We just all need to go vegan or we need to just stop wasting food. There are a lot of these, magic bullet solutions. And it's true. Those would be great if we all did that, but we're not. And since there doesn't, perfect doesn't seem to be on the menu, let's go for better. That's kind of my...
What did you see in Brazil that gave the cattle ranchers there the ability to be 4 or 5 times more productive per acre? What was the secret there?
Well, like I said, it was really a mix of kind of some of these regenerative throwback, more natural, you could call them, type solutions, where
rotational grazing,
rotational grazing, absolutely, rather than what people like to call the Columbus method, right? Where you just let the cattle out in the fall and then you go discover them in the spring.
Yeah.
I saw a bunch of, and I also saw ranches in Brazil that were doing that. And the cattle looked like they were on hunger strikes. They were so skinny. It's very rough on the land. While this more intensive form of cattle management, which again, it takes more labor,
more money, they more were also, time, yes.
you know, they were exactly, they were integrating it with their crops, which is another thing that, and the cop, they were planting cover crops that the cows were eating. They were doing no-till, which was good for the soil. A lot of that, but then some real, and they had feedlots. And the sad thing was that this feedlot, one of the feedlots I visited, they had, I think 39 neighboring ranches were sending their cows to this feedlot. And only two of the other ranches were doing any of those sustainable ranching techniques. So it's going to take time and it's going to take money. And as I do describe in the book, there were a lot of big promises made to Brazil that if, hey, if you do the right thing, if you protect the Amazon, if you do things to stop deforestation, the international community is going to reward you with lots of money. And the international community did not keep its promises.
There's a surprise.
And that has created big political problems. Yeah. Well, it's created, that's sort of why, that created a lot of political problems in Brazil, and it's created climate problems for all of us.
There you go. Speaking of efficiencies, we look to the city and the prospect of vertical farming. You mentioned China, which is actually a very good example of the concept. So instead of having pigs spread out over acres, you put them in a skyscraper, and there you go. And that way, all of the fecal matter goes downhill. So all you have to do is maybe sit there at the bottom of the shovel, and there you go. But it's kind of a unsettling notion to think they were eating pigs that were raised in a skyscraper like that. But that seems to be a direction of agriculture. And I think specifically of tower gardens where you stack plants on top of each other up into the ceiling. I first saw this in Milwaukee quite a few years ago. And here in California, we have a berry company called Driscoll's, who's really been doing a lot to perfect this technology, because that would allow Driscoll's to grow berries anywhere and avoid the stoop labor that is involved in strawberries now. So I've seen a couple of pieces from you, and one would suggest that it's has a bright future, and the other not so much. What do you think of it?
Oh, I don't think I've ever suggested that it has a super bright future, because I was, I wrote a piece back when, Arrow Farms and Bowery and Plenty all had billion-dollar valuations. I wrote a column saying that that vertical farming was never going to pencil out.
Sell short.
Now all three of those companies have gone bankrupt. And look, I think that they will solve some. I think vertical farms will end up working for lettuce, which, let's face it, it's mostly water, and it doesn't really make sense to truck that stuff around the country. Strawberry is such a high margin commodity. I think that can someday work in vertical farms. Weed, also a very nice high margin crop. I think I can see that working vertically. But we're not going to feed the world with this stuff. Nobody's really figured out how to grow the staple crops that provide more than 90% of the world's calories in a vertical farm. What I do think the allure of the vertical farm, and look, the problems are energy and the math. But you what it does do is it's like an answer for the problems of outdoor farming, right? You know, all these things with that make it really hard, like night and weather and, you know, and birds pooping on your crops and, you know, and all these, you know, funguses and, you know, pests and just all these things that make it really hard to grow stuff, you know, to turn sunlight and soil and water, you know, into these, you know, this bounty that feeds the world. It's in many ways, the allure of vertical farming is kind of a testament to the brilliance of outdoor farming, you know, of what they've been able to do. And also the problems of outdoor farming. Like, these are problems that need to be solved, but I think they're going to have to be solved outdoors. And it's interesting. One thing I, when I wrote about AeroFarms, one of the things I pointed out is that, you know, I didn't really think much of it as a business. I didn't really see how it was going to work. But I thought a lot of it as a lab, because they were learning more in that, you know, in Newark, sure, in downtown Newark, in this, you know, little, one little area growing, you know, enough crops that, you know, would have been 400 acres of, you know, of lettuce and Visalia. But they were learning more about how stuff grows than anybody had ever learned in the history, you know, in 12,000 years of agriculture.
Because,
right? Because they were just, you know, just like tons of data, constant imagery. You know, they could see, you know, they knew exactly how much, you know, fertilizer was going in and exactly how much of every type of nutrient and exactly how much water, and they could measure it all and every temperature. And so, I do think that, there's a lot we can learn from things like that.
Yeah.
I'm skeptical that we're ever going to feed the world that way.
I share your skepticism. I always thought that when you take nature inside, you have to become God and control everything. And to do that, you have to be as smart as God to pull it all off. Otherwise, things go missing in the formula. And, you know, plants know what they need. And there's no way for us to know all that they need when they need it. And when we are feeding plants directly into their tissue, as we do with these soluble mineral fertilizers, we have to know everything. And that was always where I saw the downfall in these space-intensive, money-intensive cropping systems. It's just a lot to pull off there.
Well, look, I see what you're saying. And, like, you know, I've been a vertical farming skeptic, so I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you say. But I also don't want to, you know, I'm not a techno skeptic. Look, I mean, the sun is pretty awesome, and so I think the idea of a farming system that doesn't exploit that pretty amazing energy source is already starting from, you know, they've got some explaining to do. But look, technology, I think, is a pretty alluring solution to a lot of these problems.
No.
You know, I'm sitting here with a device in my pocket that I can use to video chat with anyone anywhere in the world and look up any fact that the human race has discovered within seconds. And I can also use it as a flashlight. So I try not to say that things are impossible. You know, I do think that, you know, and I do in the book, I'm very optimistic, or at least intrigued by a lot of technological solutions for food as well as agriculture.
Michael Grunwald, we have a few minutes left, and that's what the word I wanted to hear was, optimistic. What are you optimistic about?
Well, I think humans are, we're pretty bad at being nice to each other. We're pretty bad at changing our behaviors. You know, we're pretty bad at sacrificing for the greater good, unless our backs are really up against the wall. But we're really good at inventing stuff, and we're really good at progress. It doesn't usually go in a straight line, but, you know, we come up with cool stuff. And so I am not optimistic that, you know, people like me are going to get up on our soapboxes and say, like, you got to eat less beef. And the people of the world will say, why, Michael Grunwald, you are correct. You have made such an excellent mathematical and logical case. We are going to eat less meat. That is not the way the world works. I have more. That's where I have more confidence in these scientists and technologists who are kind trying to come up with alternative proteins, who are trying to, you know, grow fake meat from plants, mm-hmm. or actual real meat from animal cells, or meat from fungi, or who knows what. You know, right now it doesn't taste good enough and it isn't cheap enough. But in the future, who knows? I'm really optimistic about these people working on these agricultural problems to try to turn crop residues into better animal feed, to try to come up with biological nitrification inhibitors, which make me really not very fun at parties, but can really do a lot to reduce our nitrous oxide emissions. You know, there are guys at the University of Illinois who are trying to reinvent photosynthesis, which has, you know, done a pretty good job of supporting life on Earth for the last few billion years, but it turns out is pretty inefficient. Yeah. And through gene editing and supercomputers and AI, they're starting to make it more efficient. So yeah, I'm optimistic that, you know, I see what's happened with energy, where 20 years ago, there were no alternatives to fossil fuels that had any market traction. And today, yeah, like, you know, anybody who's building a power plant is using clean energy. So
at
can
least
things change?
Here in the United States.
Yeah. Well, almost everywhere. It's certainly the fastest growing form of new, yeah, electricity generation. And you know, I try to, you know, when you look at the problem, and none of the solutions I write about in the book have really gotten much traction yet, because honestly, as a society, as a species, we haven't really tried to solve these problems yet.
Because we haven't had to, right?
Yeah, well, you know, we haven't really focused on it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do have some confidence that if we do focus on it, you know, we can make some headway, and we can at least make things better. And that, as I said, is better than worse.
Well, we'll do this one.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.